The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
I made a grab at anything. The earth was gone, and I was on a vicious circle then. And I have to think that the vicious circle was him grabbing at anything, which could mean any opportunity to get his music out there, also at any person that would accept him, because we know he was very easily taken in by females.
Yes. And, he sure was.
And the vicious cycle was that he wasn't finding what he sought, whether that was love or acceptance or whatever. And what he did not realize when he was that young, and that most men realize, is that they can get sex from any woman, but they can't get love from every woman, and they can't get contentment from just any place.
And I think that's another great view, because it also brings, I think, into the forefront, after Brita, after that marriage was over, he was going from woman to woman. You almost feel that it wasn't necessarily like he was just sleeping around. There seemed to be this intense insecurity in being alone. And if a woman says she loves me, of course, logically, I know that's not true because we don't really know each other, but she's a warm body for the night. Or in longer relationships, those were also formed only with either they were fans or they worked for somebody he knew up until his last marriage. But prior to that, I mean, he got Kathy Smith. Well, she was working at the riverboat, and it was Ian who sort of introduced her to him. And then you go through all these other women. One of the ladies that he loved, he met her in the middle of one of his concerts. She had been up on the front of the stage taking photos of him. She wasn't pressed. She didn't have a pass. So security grabbed her, and they were dragging her away. And of course, he's a sucker for a blonde, and that's what she was. He halts the concert, tells them to like unhand her. She ends up backstage, and it seemed like he didn't have relationships afterwards that were on equal footing, the way that he had with Brita.
Oh, yeah, which is not to put those other women down.
Absolutely not. They all cared about him, and he made it very difficult, but I definitely do not want to put any of them down.
No, but I think it also speaks to him realizing on some level that these women are vulnerable and I need acceptance. And that, again, is not to throw stones at him because he's a human being. We all make mistakes, but there may be some psychology going on there.
And I think the difficulty with this song, why it's sort of hard to approach, is you don't want to like tear the guy down, but you don't want to tear down any other woman as well. But you kind of have to look at the place he was at that time in his head, and that he wasn't going to come out the other end for quite a while.
No, and it's going to take getting older, but it's going to take also other incidents for that to happen. After I'd gone and let myself surrender, I didn't want to die at all. I thought I'd live forever. And it sounds like he's talking about surrendering. Okay, I'm going to fall in love with this person or allow myself to fall in love with Brita. He didn't want to die at all. And on one level, that means at some point he did want to die. But it also goes to the feeling of a young man in love when you are just feeling like nothing can stop you.
And women feel that way, too.
I'm only speaking from my own experience.
No, I'm just saying it's interesting because it's a feeling of this loss of control, this giddiness, a euphoria. You don't even feel gravity. It's like you're on a roller coaster doing those loops where you're coming up out of the seat. And it's just an incredible sense of not being able to control yourself at all at that point. Your emotions are just everywhere, and that can be good and bad.
Bob Dylan said it best. He said, you can't be wise and in love at the same time. And speaking as a Dylan fan, okay, I don't think I've ever heard truer words from the man or from any other songwriter, including Mr. Lightfoot. Then she gave me everything a king could never borrow. Okay, we're back with kings again. But I twisted all her gifts. Her wisdom was my sorrow. So he is right here lauding her contribution to his life. You talked about the investments that she made. You talked about the patience that she had had with him and with him being gone. And as we find out later, he was in and out of affairs on the road. But then he's also kind of taking responsibility for wrecking this relationship. Now, you said that the divorce wouldn't come down, but he realizes the mistakes that he's made. And he's realizing he doesn't deserve this, like I mentioned earlier. I love the lyric that says, "Twisted all her gifts." I thought, wow, what would that have looked like? And I'm not sure I really want to know because it's none of my business, but
right.
I just love the way that you phrase that.
It's something that you know in your mind that you know what he's talking about. And it's so private. Again, you don't want to give words to it, but he is a writer who broke a rule that songwriters are taught never write about anything that's too personal. You'll make the audience uncomfortable. But he continually broke that rule and did it successfully. What a line. And I twisted all her gifts. We don't need to know. We can imagine. And I think it goes back to imagery, too, and just the perfect word choices.
I don't know that it was too personal because he wasn't giving sordid details, but he said it in just the right way. And again, it's probably that workhorse mentality. Okay, how is the exact way that I'm going to get this across? What words am I going to use to do that? So I left her crying and roamed across the river. The angels offered me their hands, but I could not forget her. Now, as usual here, I'm going to read too much into this. Roamed across the river. I don't know if he's speaking metaphorically, you know,
right.
Like crossed over something that is dividing them.
If it's a Canadian river reference.
Well, the St. Lawrence would make right. the most sense because that kind of indicates he went into the States to get away from her, either deliberately, I got to get as far away from you as I can, or that's where the touring was going to take me. Because let's face it, there's an enormous market in the States, was then, is now, arguably bigger than the one in Canada. And certainly in those days, with the economic ability to buy stuff, I don't know if the Canadians didn't have that. I'm only speaking by...
Well, I can speak to that a little bit. I was right on the border, so he benefited actually greatly from the Canadian rule, which I think you probably know, the radio rule.
Yeah.
The content rule. So he was actually doing pretty good for himself, even though he wasn't famous in America. Plus, he had all those covers. And that was generating a ton of money, or the recordings, rather, the songs. So he's relatively, with the help of Rita, again, being very money smart, doing quite well. I'm not sure that America necessarily was something he wanted to conquer. He sometimes had a lackadaisical attitude about exactly what he wanted.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that he deliberately said, I'm going to go out and conquer the United States. I'm just saying that there was money there. There were listeners there. Can you say a little bit more about the content rule? Because I know that most of my listeners are not in Canada, so they don't necessarily know what that means.
Well, back in 1973, there wasn't enough Canadian music being played on Canadian radio. So the government came up with what was called the 70-30 rule. And that is that radio stations in Canada had to make sure that at least 30% of their musical content was Canadian.
By Canadian artists.
By Canadian artists, thank you. And actually some radio stations that were on the border states, like New Hampshire, I think there was Vermont and a couple of others. We also had radio stations in the States right on the border who followed that rule. They didn't necessarily legally have to, but they were kind of fell into it, especially in New Hampshire, which is nicknamed Little Canada. We got a lot of Canadian influence here, interestingly enough. And I remember growing up, it was really normal to hear the French-Canadian Quebec musicians who are on the radio. But in Canada, 30% had to be Canadian musicians. Okay. And that's kind of how he got into this sort of joke with Anne Murray that we're the only two people they ever play in Canada.
I also can appreciate something that you and I have talked about, that Gordon remains steadfastly Canadian in a way that many of his counterparts didn't. We hear about people who move to the States and they never come back, or they become American citizens, or they are just working in the States so much that they never end up going home again, and they lose their identification with Canada, except on paper.
And I think, too, with Gordon, when he passed away, I can tell you that the sense and the feeling, we didn't lose somebody, this famous musician. We lost somebody who was our neighbor, our friend. He was a guy down the street. He was a guy in a rural town, the big city. He was a Canadian who didn't give up that Canadianness. He didn't abandon us. He didn't end up going to Detroit or upstate New York like Joni and Neil. Not anything against them, but I can tell you that when their time comes where they pass on, it's not going to be the same sense of loss.
Not by Canadians, yes. I can understand that.
I know how much he meant to an older generation. We weren't old enough of that 1960s, sort of that early 70s, or as my dad called them in the early 70s with his blonde curly hair, Canadian Jesus.
I was a war baby in 1972, so I listened to it, but of course I wasn't cognizant of it until I started reading the history of it. Just to clear up the next part of that lyric, the angels offered me their hands. I had originally thought, okay, well, he's talking about Los Angeles. No, he's not. He's talking about the other women that have offered, hey, you know, come with me and all.
Yeah, I know. Come true. You know. You're right. That's very astute. A lot of people don't get that. That's essentially what he is saying, that now that I have all these women, because she's not here, I'm realizing I don't want them. What was I thinking? At that time as well, he had multiple girlfriends in like California that he was seeing, and somebody out in Hawaii, and another person was a school teacher he met while he was driving across Canada.
That was Marianne.
That's what I thought. So he's standing back and it's like, all these songs I wrote about all these women, and now I don't want them.
It's the idea that I once heard a pastor say, God will give you what you want, but once you get it, you won't want it.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Have you checked out the Dylan Taunts? It's a podcast full of smart conversations with interesting Dylan scholars, academics, and fans. Find it at fmpods.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I just wanted to take a second to tell you about my latest podcast discovery. Fire-Breathing Kittens is an actual play one-shot podcast that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Yeah, you won't miss a thing. Every week has a different combination of four from the same rotating cast of people. Join Fire-Breathing Kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship. That's Fire-Breathing Kittens podcast. Check it out. So I came to where she was by river, road, and reason. I slept beneath her window in the moonlight summer season. Beautiful stuff.
Beautiful.
By river, road, and reason. So basically any road he could have taken to get back to her or to get with her again.
He could have been sitting with philosophers again with the reason part. Like, how do I do this logically? How do I get back to her? No, it's not just that physical.
Well, yeah, although I tend to think he was thinking, what's the reasonable thing to do? And he might have been thinking, come on, this doesn't make any sense. It's not logical, like love could ever be logical.
Right. And so it's, again, a knight on this sort of quest for the maiden.
Yeah. You know? Okay. I like the way you said that. I think about the Percy Sledge song, When a Man Loves a Woman, where he says he'd give up all of his comforts and sleep out in the rain if she says that's the way it ought to be. And again, very true. These are the actions of a man in love. But I could not go inside. I heard the sound of laughter and the rustle of her hair upon his skin. Oh, wow. The implication is that she's moved on, although I don't know if Britta had done that. My sense is that she hadn't.
Right, because I think that this is him imagining all the worst possible scenarios that could happen. And I think, too, it's him. His ego thinks that she's going to be in her room crying for him.
Yeah.
The way that he's yearning for her. Guess what? Mm-hmm. She's not. And that line, her hair rustling against his skin, and he hears laughter.
So it is ego expecting that she's going to be waiting there for him. I knew you'd come back. I knew you'd come back. But also this idea that I've lost her, and it's in a measurable way that she is with somebody else. And even if she doesn't love this new man, she's giving her body to him, which means something.
I think to me, it represents that she's come a little bit closer now to earthly delights. And maybe that's him thinking somehow he corrupted her.
Okay, I hadn't thought of that. I mean, we did hear about angels, but he wasn't talking about her in terms of being an angel.
No, but I just thought that the whole image right there of her laughing plays against how he's told us about her up until that point, where she's not of this world. That's the feeling I get from the whole song, is she was not of the world that he was used to. He's not tied to it the way that he was. There was a ritual quality and something, again, then we loop around to he's now hearing her in some sort of intimate context, which he would have never thought of before unless it was with him.
And then the rest of the song, I think, pretty much stands alone. After I'd gone to cry down my sorrow, I didn't want to live no more nor face the bright tomorrow, because he realizes he has blown it.
It's such a simple line. A lot of times people say, oh, he writes such simple lines. But that's what makes these things powerful. Because if you've ever had your heart crushed, you are angry that the sun is shining. How dare that sun shine? How dare people still laugh? How dare the world still goes on with happiness? It should be in mourning with me, in grief. There should be no sun, no moon. The stars shouldn't be shimmering. It's an insult to how much I loved this person and how much pain I'm in.
Yeah. And when you're healing from a broken heart, you can't help but be self-centered. I think that's a very forgivable sin.
Absolutely.
I remember all those lines giving me direction. So he's closing the circle. Gather not your gold on earth. It will not pass inspection. So he's realizing, they told me, I didn't listen. And still, I think when I'm alone, away from all night splendor, if gold could buy one night with her, I wish I had some to send her. So that's a perfect way to end. She's out of reach, but I'd give it all up. I'd give up all of the gains that I've made, which in 1969 was still not very much. If I could just be back with her, or if I could turn back the clock or things like
that. When I'm away from the distractions of night splendors. So we know he wrote a song, never got recorded it. There's a bootleg, Pleasures of the Night, where he's, no woman's going to hold me back from experiencing the pleasures of the night. It's a great song, but it definitely spells out his mindset. And then you come to this, where away from all those distractions of the women, wine, and what we talked about before, where she falls into all these things, when he's not doing that, he is stuck with that unbearable regret. And even there's a certain sense of emotional self-flagellation in this.
And I think that is normal and expected and healthy and probably proper, probably a right notion. So the song appeared on the Sunday Concert album in 1969. It was the seventh track on the record. It was the first song on side B. So if people were flipping the record over, they were going to hear that first. It was not released as a single, but then neither was any other song on the album. Live albums, I think, until maybe Frampton Comes Alive, were not the greatest quality and maybe were not designed for singles, which is not to say they didn't have great performances, but when you're dealing with live concerts, it's more of a crapshoot.
Right. You know, the technology isn't necessarily there either at that point to give, I think, what he would want in his way of being a perfectionist. I mean, this is a guy, we remember, that didn't release a live album from Massey Hall because he thought he could hear his fingernail scratching too much on the guitar. And, you know, so that's somebody who, he has his quirks and oddities, but they work together to make a great artist.
But you make a good point, though, about the technology, that these days we could get rid of that kind of thing. Okay.
Right.
But back in 1969, that was one of the reasons why Creedence didn't allow their performance at Woodstock to come out, because there wasn't any way to edit out the farts, the bleeps, the missed notes,
right,
the fatigue of the artists, you know, all those kinds of things. You were a victim of whatever you put down in a performance. Now they can process things and patch things so well that he could have gotten away with much more, but that's Monday morning quarterbacking.
I think one of the interesting, mentioning that just quickly, The Last Waltz is often lauded as that's the best concert performance that's been recorded. And the interesting thing about that, though, is that Martin Scorsese and Robbie Robertson want to actually go back and re-record certain sections, some sort of overdub. But LaVon Helm, the drummer, said, no way. This is how it happened. This is the way it is. I'm not going back and re-recording something to make it sound more perfect. This is live. And so they never did. I just thought that was interesting how you got those two sides, sort of like you said, because this is around Frampton Comes Alive period that they're working on this.
And another example of that would have been the Four-Way Street album by CSNY, where some of the band was saying, look, this isn't the Mills Brothers at Carnegie Hall. Let's lay this in one more time. Okay. And then you have another side of the band saying, no, man, it's got to be pure.
I did just want to quickly loop back to my parents, because one of the things I'm really grateful for, but my parents had such a great record collection. And it's because of that, that I was able to remain open-minded. And I noticed that about Gordon Lightfoot too, although he was a little bit, I don't want to really leave this area that he inhabited, but he was open. You could hear like the crooning. They were still crooning in his voice. You could hear Bing Crosby. You know, his mom loved Bing Crosby. You could hear that crooning every once in a while. It came alive in him. I just thought it was interesting that he grabbed, even in a song, say, Sundown and Slide On Over, there's a bluesiness to that that doesn't really get mentioned. It's quite a slinky, bluesy bass that he's got going in there.
Talking about the influences that are there, thank God for both our sets of parents, because they did have great taste in music. They had great record collections. And we had the radio, which was something.
Do you remember the radio?
Yeah, local radio. It wasn't the network garbage that we have these days.
I had WBCM. I was in New Hampshire, Boston, Carter Allen, 8 till midnight on weeknights. It was like, oh my God, it's my gateway to all kinds of music. Think now, how would a Gordon Lightfoot even go around? I mean, there's a lot of successful independent artists, but they're never going to be heard by a million people on the radio worldwide where there's this massive hit, unless you're looking at manufactured pop we have now.
Well, you also have a system where local radio is dying, if it isn't already dead, that it is controlled by huge networks. And so a lot of what we're getting now in pop music is coming out through Spotify. It's not to take anything away from some of these artists, but it is to say that the emphasis is no longer on truth and expression and beauty. It is entirely about money. If it wasn't about money before, it's certainly about money now. And the streaming industry has really done in a lot of independent artists and a lot of established artists. Now, we're not going to get on a soapbox about that right now because you and I both have other things to do today. But I wanted to just bring that up in terms of how the industry has changed.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Hi, this is Audie Martello, the host of the Mostly Folk podcast, a 60-minute foray into the music we all love. You will hear newly released albums, classic folk, country, and bluegrass music, as well as some traditional music that may or may not be true to the genre. Sometimes irreverent, often opinionated, but always entertaining. You may even hear a radio magic trick every so often. as well as numerous interviews via Zoom and telephone with established as well as indie artists. Mostly Folk is available wherever you listen to podcasts, and always at mostlyfolk.org.
One minute, you're a teacher preparing for the new school year. The next, you're transported to a fantastical realm shrouded in forgotten magic. The creatures around you think you're a long-vanished mage. You have no technology. You have no memory of how you got here, and no idea how to get home. All you have is misplaced magic. Haladar, the Last Surveyor, is the new fantasy novel by acclaimed author Rob Perrier. Available now on Amazon.com and RobPerrier.com.
So the record did not chart in either Australia or the UK. It did get to 21 in Canada and made 143 on the Billboard 200.
It's not an enormous impact
in the States. Usually I would mention that I have a favorite part of the song, but I've already mentioned that. I mean, the chord progression that he used,
right,
which is not to take anything away from what Red did with his fills or what Rick Haynes did on the bass, because John Stockfish had left by that time. But the chord progression is the thing that really stood out to me about this song, not the other instrumental side of this. Was there any particular musical aspect of it that we haven't talked about yet that you enjoyed?
It's actually the same on my end, that whole musical progression. And the idea to that, I know that other professional musicians really admire his own musicianship. You get into finger picking and that whole area. He was a genius at that. And I think he came up with some of these chord progressions that I hadn't heard before in any other way. I get a little frustrated because I think overall that musicianship part of him gets kind of pushed into the back by just everyday listeners. There's not really a great tip of the hat to that.
And I think it's also because he never did anything like as a session man. He wasn't part of a really well-established band where he played a lot of lead guitar. So people overlooked that. And he also had Red Shea and Terry Clements. And so how do you compete with that? You can't, because they were tremendous musicians. And so his own musicianship, they focused on the song, they focused on the singing, but they didn't focus on him up there with that 12 string, which is, as you know, it's trickier to play than it may look.
Oh, yeah. And what's the joke about how long does it take to tune a 12 string? Nobody knows, because it's never been done.
Because it's never been done. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The song, as we've said, was never played in concert except for this live recording.
Right.
Now, you said there might have been a bootleg, but as far as official releases and official, as far as setlist.fm says, it was never played. And I have to think that by the time that song was released, his career had taken this very different tack, because, you know, you have If You Could Read My Mind, and Apology is not a short song. It's over 4 minutes, and it does take a certain amount of, I don't want to say effort, but it is not.
You could say that.
Yeah. Okay.
You say that.
It's not as accessible as some of his other songs. So I think he may have just said, there's no time to play it in concert because we've only got so much time. They want to hear the hits. So thank you very much. Here's the next big thing. I do wish he'd played it in his later years, but he chose not to.
I think in his later years, and I really do appreciate the later albums that get knocked a lot or they're not listened to, even by some people who are lifelong fans. But I think that he came out with some incredible songs from that time period. And I would have loved to have heard a sort of an acoustic version of Apology in his later years, with that voice that's all crackled and that has lived life. I've never seen that as a weakness so much as somebody who survived.
Just the fact that his voice got old, no, was never a weakness to me. I don't feel good about the fact that he was a smoker for as many years as he was, right, because that does wreak havoc on your voice. But just the fact that his voice was weathered, no, I don't think that's a detriment at all. At the same time, there are no covers of this song. I mean, apart from people getting on YouTube and playing it, it's certainly not because of the quality of the song. It's just because it was on a live album. There was no studio version of it. It was never played again. And I think a lot of people missed it, frankly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are people now who, again, are the lifelong fans. And it's like they've heard it for the first time if I share it online or something. Like, where'd that come from? You know?
It's like Buddy Holly fans who will listen to Peggy Sue, but they forgot about Peggy Sue Got Married.
And I think another interesting thing, because I'm younger, I'm not always thought of as knowing a whole lot about him or being a real true fan because I wasn't born yet. There are a lot of younger people, and younger than me, they're in their 20s or 30s. They're listening to Bob Dylan and Gordon Lightfoot, and they are rappers, and they are appreciating the flow, the cadence, the word choice, and rap is, at its essence, storytelling.
Oh, and yeah. They
are appreciating the storytelling. And he's had his songs covered by some rap artists. And I think that's fascinating as well, that there are young people in all genres who do know who he is and appreciate him.
Hallelujah for that. And I've had a few people that are my age or younger on the show. Not many, but I have had a few. And I think the fact that they are discovering Lightfoot and Dylan, and that those songs are being reinterpreted, it speaks to the quality of the song, because if it's a crappy song, nobody's going to want to reinterpret it in the first place because nobody listened to it. So, Harlow, as we're sort of wrapping up here, anything else you wanted to say about this song or about Lightfoot's music in general?
There are very few people on this planet who I would say are able to communicate so well universal human feelings in a way in which they're using their own experience, because he did. Sure, he didn't always, but the fact that he was willing to be so vulnerable, open to criticism, and that he was also at the same time masculine. What fascinates me about him so much is that he was able to wrap together the masculine part of himself and actually the feminine part. Again, you see this rugged guy coming out on stage, but he's incredibly sensitive. And I think that's part of what his magic is. It's sort of what can leave me just in tears, even though I've heard a song hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's a reason why you can't really pin down, what are your top 10 songs? I can tell you it changes every day almost. Because everybody goes back to Bob Dylan said, but he wrote back in 1988 that yes, Gordon Lightfoot was his favorite singer. And that says a lot. But I hope that we're able to get back to this type of songwriting again, this storyteller or conversational songwriting. I don't want it to die. That I mentioned Bobby Gentry and Ode to Billy Joe and American Pie and all those great song stories. I just really, really hope there's some sort of way that this can come back to be in a more popular way than just the independent route, because it's universal. Again, as I said, he's also very, very much talking about personal stuff. And I can only imagine the mining of that and how that takes a toll on a human being. I just have a lot of respect for him in that area. And also for the fact that he did something that few people can do in music. And that's when he became sober in 83 or 84, he realized that music could not be his number one on the list of what was most important in his life. It was family. It was reestablishing connections. And a lot of that goes back to Brita, because Brita could have certainly made their two children despise him. She always kept those doors of communication open for him and for them. She didn't talk badly about him to Fred and Ingrid. And you can hear that today, especially with Ingrid, who grew very close with him, how much I think, wow, again, Brita doing this incredible grace. She was showing him grace because she didn't stop talking to him after the divorce either. That communication stayed open even when they were having some tough times. The door never shut for either of them. I think that in itself is a powerful statement to this relationship, that it transcended the hurt, the pain, all of the craziness. And I also know that Jennings had mentioned in his book that Brita actually was one of the people who came in towards the tail end of 1980 to be one of the voices to say, you've got to stop drinking, you know, not be angry and frustrated. And Gordon would credit her, along, of course, with Beverly and his mom, as being these forces that never, never abandoned him. So I think that's, again, why that song is so powerful, because he did lose somebody who clearly was in his corner. The what ifs haunted him for the rest of his life and appeared in song. So that's about it.
He did learn his lesson, but as we know, it was a painful one to learn, and it took him a very, very long time. Yeah. Arlo Rio Monroe, thank you so much for joining me here today. I know we've been talking about it for a while. You did not disappoint.
You're so very welcome and very patient and kind, Michael, because I'm used to being up in front of people. I'm used to doing this, but for some reason, I think it was just because the power of the song and thoughts and the feelings that it was going to bring up.
I hope to have you back on the show again real soon.
I would actually like to do that, and I won't be a nervous mess. Thank you. Thank you again, Michael. I do love this show, and you do a great job, and that should be acknowledged.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com.
Well, the next episode of Carefree Highway Revisited will feature my guest, Brittany Jean, and she and I will be talking about The Pony Man from the If You Can Read My Mind album in 1970 that was also covered on the Gord's Gold 2 compilation. That episode will be coming out in March of 2025. Until then, for Harlow Rio Monroe, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them.